Obviously, the tutorial has put people off, I think. Right, so today, as advertised, I want to discuss black hole thermodynamics. And I'm going to be using a Euclidean approach and applying this Gauss-Kadatze formalism that we did yesterday in calculating the action of a black hole. But before doing that, I thought it might just be useful to kind of go back and think a little bit about the solutions that we've met and to see why people thought black holes might have some thermodynamical properties in the first place. So I'm going to look at this Kerr metric. We kind of analyzed it in a bit of detail earlier in the week and looked at its properties and as a black hole, as an object out there in the universe. But today we want to look at some more theoretically at this metric. So if I just sort of think about a few more abstract properties of the metric, we said the other day that delta equals zero was the event horizon. And I kind of motivated that by looking at null geodesics and saying that if I looked at least equatorial geodesics, then if I had, there was a null circular geodesic in the extremal case that was kind of just grazing the event horizon. And if I just pushed that a little bit one way or the other, so in other words, same angular momentum, but you're just giving it a tiny little flick, then if it went slightly outside R plus, it escaped to infinity. Slightly inside, it was absorbed by the black hole. So that was kind of a motivation for why delta equals zero was the event horizon without sort of explicitly showing that all null geodesics coming from just outside delta equals zero escape to infinity. So there's a few other things that we can notice about this black hole. We've got various parameters. We've got, well, two only, the M and A. So M is related to the mass, so we get that either by comparing with Schwarzschild, or if we want to think about what is the mass of the black hole, the other way of doing it is going off to large R and looking at the fall off in the different terms in the metric. So here, M corresponds to a 1 over R fall off, and that's kind of a monopole or Newtonian type of fall off, and it's associated with mass. So and indeed, if we take a sort of an integration, you know, when we did the Schwarzschild solution or the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equations for a fluid star, then we actually could directly associate this mass with an integral of T naught naught. So it is what we intuitively think of as mass. And then this A parameter, A also kind of comes in as a charge at infinity. So you can see that if I go off to infinity, I mean, this sort of d phi, d theta pieces look like a normal two-sphere, but d phi as a sort of covector has an inherent length of 1 over r. So this kind of indicates that there's a sort of 1 over r charge of this black hole, which is kind of like the angular momentum. So here, so J is the real angular momentum of the black hole, but A is the parameter that's telling you that the black hole is rotating. So we talked about the ergosphere and the event horizon. So the event horizon, wrote it down last time, is given by the root of delta, which is now less than 2gm. So 2gm is the Schwarzschild radius. When you add rotation and also charge, which is, I think, either a tutorial or homework question, when you add things to the black hole, the event horizon seems to shrink, when you add extra charges, that is. And then the area of the event horizon is r plus squared plus a squared. So you kind of see that from saying when I'm sitting on the event horizon, it's just the d theta, d phi pieces that are relevant. And so here you've got that r plus squared plus a squared sitting in there. So the area of the event horizon is maybe r plus gets a bit smaller, but then you add back on again to get the area of the event horizon. So there's sort of various ways in which this is changing from Schwarzschild as a result of the angular momentum. So what I'm going to do now is to think about little changes in that area, because really the start of black hole thermodynamics was imagining applying thermodynamics to the universe as a whole and thinking about entropy and sort of imagining the black hole as kind of the universal vacuum cleaner. And so if you had a very disordered universe, and then you could just throw everything into a black hole, and that would kind of clean it up. So what was going on? Because usually in thermodynamics, we imagine that entropy has to increase. That's the second law. So if the black hole could just take all this disorder, sweep all the entropy under the carpet, you know, this looked like it was going to be a violation of the second law. So that was really the puzzle that people were thinking about in the 1960s. So if I look at the area of my event horizon, what I want to think about is if I try throwing all this disorder into my black hole, obviously the black hole doesn't stay exactly the same. It's going to react. You throw mass into it, it's going to get heavier. If you throw some mass into it with angular momentum, perhaps it's going to spin up. So we have to sort of say, well, what happens to our black hole as a result of throwing things into it? So our area, which is 4 pi r plus squared plus a squared, is going to change. It's going to change as a result of the horizon changing and as a result of angular momentum changing. So if I look at how my horizon changes, well, the horizon will change if the mass changes. The horizon also, the horizon radius also changes if A varies as well. So there's two pieces there. So I've simply taken delta R plus here. But now I want to think about what is delta A. Well, A was J over M, so I have to vary my A parameter, which could change if the mass changes, and it also changes if angular momentum changes. So I've got two contributions there. So I'm just going to put that together. So now I've kind of split off the change in the area because the mass is increasing and the change in the area because the angular momentum is increasing. And I've rewritten this, for reasons which will become apparent, this change for delta J in terms of what we call the angular velocity of the event horizon. So basically it's saying angular momentum is like, I guess, r squared omega. So it's just dividing by this r squared plus a squared, which is kind of telling us about the area of the event horizon. So if I now rearrange this, notice that what I've now got is both terms are multiplied by the, just realized I put area as r plus squared plus a squared, should be 4 pi times that, sorry, add a 4 pi there. Both terms are multiplied by something that looks like the area of the event horizon. So, and I've got a delta a on the other side. So I can kind of rewrite this as an expression for the change in mass of the black hole. So there's that common factor really sitting in front of delta m and omega delta j, and then what's left is this sort of remaining delta A piece. So here I could compare this by with our standard sort of thermodynamical type of relation. The change in internal energy is the temperature times the change in entropy, pressure times change in volume, and then the change in various charges times their chemical potentials. So here, this, you can sort of see that we're going to, this makes sense, the charge is like the angular momentum, and this angular velocity of the horizon is like the potential for that. And then here, ds, we're going to associate ds with a change in the area. So if I make those associations, then I've got a direct analogy with thermodynamics. So although we can imagine throwing junk, our disordered junk, into the black hole, it comes at a price. If I, you know, maybe it changes the angular momentum of the black hole, but more importantly, from the second law perspective, it's also going to change entropy. So this was the reasoning that Bekenstein used to deduce that maybe, or to at least postulate that black holes had an entropy, and that entropy was proportional to the area of their event horizons. So notice that this T goes to 1 over 8 pi gm for the Schwarzschild solution. Mm-hmm.
When you solve for the event horizon to find its coordinates, there's also an inner horizon.
Yes, I haven't, as far as I'm concerned, I'm discussing what happens in our universe, but it's true there are two routes, yeah.
So we could have also some thermodynamics associated to it?
Not from our perspective, no. And also the other issue with inner horizons is that they tend to be unstable. So in terms of any perturbations that you get tend to blue shift on inner horizons. So, you know, it's a bit of a moot point. So I'm focusing on the part of space-time that's relevant for us. So it's really just this outer event horizon, the event horizon of the black hole, that's relevant from our perspective. So that's the one that increases, the area increases if you throw mass into a black hole. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, can you explain the identification between the charge and the angular momentum?
It's just this is analogy at this point. It's saying that this is the thermodynamic expression. This is the black hole expression, and I want to draw the analogy between the two of them. Now, if we were just in the Schwarzschild space and just throwing pure mass into a black hole, we wouldn't have this second term. And so really, we'd just be looking to identify the first term with TDS. However, in the Kerr black hole, and indeed in a charged black hole, Riesman-Nordström, you get additional pieces that look like mu delta Q. So in this case, you know that like the angular momentum is the charge. It's the, you know, it's inertia charge. It's something that's conserved in the absence of, you know, any interactions. And so that's a very natural identification. And then the omega, if we look at how it was defined, that's also got a natural interpretation in terms of representing the angular velocity of the horizon, which is the parameter you would expect to multiply any shift in angular momentum. So it's not saying that, you know, neither of these are an automatic, oh, well, obviously, you know, that's entropy. It is done by looking at, by analogy, plus the fact that in classical processes, if you can show that in any interaction with a black hole, if you throw matter inside a black hole, its area always increases, provided, you know, you've got positive energy conditions. So that's another kind of rationale. The fact that the area increases in a sort of standard classical process is analogous to entropy always increasing.
Why wouldn't the PdV term be involved in a more natural identification with delta A?
Sorry, PdV?
Yeah, TdS minus PdV.
Well, V is a volume. So I recommend you ask your Psi fellow about PdV terms, because actually there is, you know, there's sort of been in the past few years, and it's something that David's worked on, an additional identification of that PdV term in terms of a changing cosmological constant. So the cosmological constant's like the P piece, and then if, you know, if the black hole changes in volume, you've got a PdV piece. But here, there's no natural, I mean, yes, the black hole is changing in volume, but there's no sort of natural pressure term to put in there.
I understand that, but I'm saying when people came up with this thermodynamic approach, why wasn't it more natural to identify something, area with the volume as it comes in the inter-energy?
Well, because one's an area and one, so the silly answer is one's an area and one's a volume, right? That's the glib answer. But the other answer is, in a thermodynamic process, dV can be positive or negative. We can squash a system or we can expand a system. With the black hole always gets bigger, classically. So, you know, that's the reason it's very natural to associate that area with entropy, because it has the same behavior that we expect for entropy. So, whereas, you know, I suppose at first, the PdV, there was just this thought, well, there isn't an analog to that. But of course, in recent years, that story has changed.
So here we identify like P and S in this way, but why there's no other way to identify P and S? Like, for example, we can find S to be like logarithm of A, and we have a R squared things, and to like, so it's like why this is a unique way to find P and S?
Well, so there's another way. I'm about to talk about temperature and ways of actually getting the temperature. So at the time, I think the area, or at least something proportional to directly proportional to the area, was very natural. I don't know. You've got to be careful, because this has to be delta of S right here. So you can't just start changing functional forms for the entropy. Otherwise, you'll change that expression there. And really, I think this was again, I guess. There was also this idea that maybe, you know, the event horizon of the black hole was kind of like a little screen, and maybe, you know, this screen could hold, you know, when you think of entropy as sort of log of states, maybe, you know, the screen could have somehow little pieces of information on it, and then, you know, little planks. So it was like almost a hologram. So, you know, these ideas were around in the 60s, this notion of having something, you know, holding information, you know, the membrane paradigm, I think it was called. But the real key piece of evidence that kind of nailed it was Stephen Hawking's calculation of the temperature of the black hole using field theory on the black hole background. So that unambiguously says that this is the temperature of the Schwarzschild black hole. And so once you've fixed that to be T, then there's no arguments about, you know, S, the constants, etc. So, you know, it was all a self-consistent picture that seemed to be right, but without, you know, the definitive calculation to say that this, yes, this really is a temperature. So, you know, like anything, there's a sort of evolution of understanding. You know, you start off with some idea. Sometimes, you know, you manage to sort it all out straight away. But sometimes you just build up evidence, things that work, things that make sense, things that look right. And then, you know, maybe after some time, somebody comes in with the definitive piece of evidence that nails it. So what we're going to do, we're not going to do that calculation of the, you know, the scattering of modes off a black hole background. What we're going to do is we're going to use the cheap and easy approach, which is the Euclidean approach. And there's a certain element of caution that you have to use here, because, of course, we know, or we sort of keep on getting told, gravity's not renormalizable, at least not in the conventional sort of field theory sense. So we know there's something slightly illegal about what we're doing, but we're going to just hold our breath and tiptoe through and hope that overall it makes sense. So I'll try and point out the bits where it kind of, where you might fall off the tightrope. So we say we're going to sort of take a partition function. Dear me. So once again, I'm setting pretty much everything except G equal to 1. So typically, you take a trace over states at a particular temperature. And the Hamiltonian here is sort of usually an integral of a Hamiltonian density. So again, this is just motivating the final expression that we've got. So beta h is simply the integral of some sort of Hamiltonian density. Now, in our Euclidean sense, this is actually going to just be the Euclidean action. So normally what we do is we expect saddle points to dominate this, so we kind of look for classical solutions, and then we usually take a fluctuation of a determinant around classical solutions. When we think about gravity, it still makes sense to think about classical solutions. It's not quite so good to take a determinant around classical solutions, because that's where you start ending up with some of the fluctuations being very badly behaved, but we're going to take this sort of just straight, if you like, a sort of almost like a tree level approach, taking just the saddle points, the classical solutions. So we're looking for classical Euclidean solutions with a characteristic periodicity, beta, whatever beta is. So let's look at our classical action, or at least Euclidean action. So yesterday, we motivated a boundary term for our action, and one of the rationales for wanting a boundary term is the fact that the bulk term, the integral of the Ricci scalar, is zero for an Einstein manifold. So Schwarzschild has zero standard Einstein-Hilbert action. So what's going to happen to the boundary term? We've kind of got to cross our fingers and hope that the boundary term gives us something sensible. So let's now look at Schwarzschild from a Euclidean perspective. So to get Euclidean Schwarzschild, we simply send t goes to I tau, we flip signs so that we end up with a completely plus, 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 plus signature metric. So that's our Euclidean solution, but is it periodic in time? And I guess you guys know that the answer is indeed yes. So what we have to do is focus on this part of the metric that has an issue at 2gm. Unlike the Lorentzian solution, where we could at least, you know, hand-wavingly, take our radial coordinate to be less than 2gm, and we say, okay, but then, you know, our time t coordinate is space-like, our r coordinate is time-like. It's a little dodgy, but it's okay. It actually makes sense to think about what the space-time is beyond the event horizon. And if we want to do it properly, we go to Kruskal's. Here, however, we can't go beyond the event horizon because if we go to our less than 2gm, the signature of our metric completely changes. It goes from all pluses to plus, plus, minus, minus. And so we really don't want to do that. So 2gm has to be a sort of end to our Euclidean space. And so the way that we do this is we look at what happens as we go to 2gm. Our radial part of the metric is dr squared over r minus 2gm. So the proper distance is like dr over root r minus 2gm. So we could redefine a proper distance, which would simply look like the square root of r minus 2gm. So we try, rho squared is some constant of proportionality times r minus 2gm. That's what we're kind of looking for. And then we know that 2 rho d rho is lambda dr. And so dr squared over r minus 2gm is equal to 4 rho squared d rho squared divided by lambda squared, and then r minus 2gm is just rho squared on lambda. So that means that, roughly speaking, that two-dimensional part of our Schwarzschild space, well, let's see. So the two-dimensional part, it should look like 2gm dr squared over r minus 2gm. And then the dt squared piece, well, that's just r minus 2gm divided by 2gm. So if I choose my lambda to be 8gm, then I've got something that looks like the origin in polar coordinates. Provided my Euclidean time coordinate is periodic and has periodicity 8 pi gm. So notice this periodicity should be, sorry, not 1 over beta, it's beta 1 over t. And what I said over here was that this temperature went to 1 over 8 pi gm for Schwarzschild. So the periodicity of Euclidean time for this Euclidean analytic continuation of Schwarzschild is what we would expect given our naive identification of temperature over in the Kerr metric. Mm-hmm.
Could you repeat how you get from this form of the metric looking like polar coordinates to a period of periodicity?
So it looks like polar coordinates because it's d rho squared plus rho squared, you know, d theta squared would be the origin in polar coordinates. But the origin in polar coordinates is got theta periodic, you know, with periodicity 2 pi. So that means tau over 4gm has periodicity 2 pi. And so if I sketch what this looks like, I've sort of got, if tau is periodic out at infinity, then we simply have a circle. This would be tau. It's periodic, so it just looks like a circle. And the circle has length 8 pi gm. But then as I come in down to, so this is my r coordinate. Here, this is r equals 2gm. As I come into r equals 2gm, the circles, my tau circles, get smaller and smaller because I'm multiplying by this factor. Meanwhile, you know, my radial distance, sort of proper radial distance, shifts as well. And so what happens is this cylinder, which is a cylinder out at large r, distorts, comes round, and then smoothly rounds off. So we sometimes call this the black hole cigar. So, of course, on top of every point in this two-dimensional surface, there's a two-sphere sitting. And right down at r equals 2gm, of course, there's a two-sphere of radius 2gm. And the two spheres get bigger and bigger as we move out. So the topology of this is S2 cross R2, because this rounded-off cylinder has topology R2, and you've got two spheres sitting on top of it. So where does this get us with our calculation of the action? Well, what I'm going to do to calculate the action, I'm going to apply a cutoff I'm going to cut off my space-time at some finite but large r. I'm going to use that boundary to calculate the integral of k, and then I'm going to see what happens as r goes to infinity. So here, this surface is delta m, and it's parameterized by tau. So the metric on my delta m is just a metric of a two-sphere of finite radius r and the Schwarzschild or Newtonian potential at that value, capital R. So my normal has to sit in the manifold. So my normal is actually, if I write it as a covector, it's just radial, purely radial, and it's got a normalization factor because I want my normal to have length of 1. So k which is the divergence of this normal vector field in the big manifold, so I get two pieces, one sort of coming from the change in r squared and one piece coming from the derivative of the, you know, the this nr. So here that's the covector. When I lift it up, I'm going to get a different factor of 1 minus 2 gm on r. So if I now integrate along that surface, well, actually, nothing really depends on anything on the surface. So I've got 4 pi r squared coming from the theta phi integral. I've got a beta coming from the tau integral. I've then got a square root of 1 minus 2 gm on r, which is the value of this nr component. And then I've got the extrinsic curvature, trace of the extrinsic curvature. So actually, there's another square root of 1 minus 2 gm on r coming from root h. Betas, that's this periodicity of Euclidean time. So beta is 1 over t. Beta is the periodicity. I've got to integrate over root h d3x. I've calculated k there. Root h is the square root of this metric here. So there's the r squared coming from that piece, and that's the square root of 1 minus 2 gm on r coming from there. The k is just transported over completely, but because nothing depends on tau, theta, or phi, I've just got this constant volume, if you like, coming from the integral over tau, theta, and phi. So the integral over tau is just beta, this 8 pi gm, and the integral over the theta phi space is the area of the two-sphere, 4 pi capital R squared. I think I should have a minus sign because my n is negative. So if I multiply all this out, I get the fact that my integral is linearly divergent. So you might worry, except the integral is also divergent if I set the mass to zero. So what that's saying is that if I try doing this boundary approach, I also would get a divergent integral, even in flat space. So what this is suggesting is that we should do a background subtraction. We need to subtract off the value of our action computed via this method in a complete vacuum background. So this is really nothing. More than a sort of method of renormalization. So in flat space, if I want to do this background subtraction, so this is what I would write for my flat space boundary metric. The r squared d omega squared piece is exactly the same, but I have to compare like with like. So I look at my background metric delta m, which is sitting here, and so I have to say, well, this dt squared, if my t has same periodicity, then I have to multiply it by 1 minus 2 gm on r. Yep?
Two questions. Why do we have an m in the flat space?
At the moment. Oh, right, here you mean?
Yeah.
Well, that was what I was just explaining. The fact is, you've got to compare like with like. So you either say that you do not have this prefactor, but then this t has a different periodicity, right? Or you put down exactly what that metric is, and t has the same periodicity. You've got to have this. This would just be a cylinder without any distortion, but your cylinder has to have the same size. So you're simply cutting off at r here, and you're matching it to a cylinder with exactly the same size, radius. So that's what you're doing. R's just a constant. Or, let me write then, if you don't like that, let me write this T1 dt2 squared plus r squared d omega squared. You could write that, but then the periodicity of T2 is now different because you have to have the same length. So that would be root 1 minus 2 gm on r times beta. You have to have the same boundary metric to do the background subtraction. You've got to compare like with like. They're the same, they have to be the same. You've got to have exactly the same boundary metric. What's different is the bulk. If you extend them off in the black hole metric, you get the cigar. In the flat space metric, you have an exact cylinder. So you're taking, if I exaggerated it, right, this could be like the black hole, right? And that would be how it would extend. This is my R. And that might carry on extending outwards like so, but I have to match my flat space time at exactly the same radius. So I have to put in a perfect cylinder that has exactly the same size. Yeah, I think, actually, can I finish the argument and then we'll go for questions at the end? Because otherwise I'm going to end up pissing off the blackboard guy. So, so I'll just finish the argument here. Okay, so if I look now at the calculation of K, because the extrinsic curvature depends on how this extends into the bulk, K is just 2 over R. But an N is simply d by dr. Actually, there's a minus sign, because of course it's multiplied by nr. So although we've got the mass entering in terms of the intrinsic metric, the metric of the bound, you know, the two sphere, or the S2 cross S1, it doesn't appear in the extrinsic curvature, because the extrinsic curvature is sampling the bulk space, which is now flat. So our integral of k0 root h here, we've still got the 4 pi r squared beta term, and we've got root 1 minus 2 gm on r, which is the sort of by how much dt squared isn't 1. But now our extrinsic curvature term is just minus 2 on r. So if I expand out my square root, if I Taylor expand it, what I get is something which is linearly divergent in exactly the same way. And there's also a order one piece. So I now get a finite result for my action. So do you want to go back now and ask me whatever the questions were about that subtraction process?
Yeah, I think we understood that now. It means like the capital R in the flat background is basically just a constant, even if we extend it to the full space.
Yeah, it's absolutely constant, yeah. It's like a factor. You are taking a cylinder and you're making it bigger or smaller to match on to exactly that place. That's what you're doing.
But back in your homework, you will basically, you know, avoid this subtraction at all.
So
because there's an invariant way how to do it. So you just subtract some curvature invariance on the boundary, and then that gives you the same result. So you don't need to think about this subtraction thing. It's a clever way to do it.
So this was how Stephen and Gary did it when they first did this sort of Euclidean approach. But it was it also has an intuitive, I mean, I think the thing that's difficult to just convince yourself is that M should be there in the flat space subtraction. And the reason it should be there is because you always have to compare things at exactly the same place. So in other words, at the same periodicity. So, mm-hmm.
It's a silly question, but how is that divergent? Divergent
Sorry?
In what?
In R. R is big and R is tending to infinity.
Oh, okay.
This is a cutoff. You know, it's standard. You know, you always sort of, if you suspect things could go wrong, you know, when you send some parameter to infinity, you cut them off, you calculate, you watch what happens as you go off to infinity, you see, uh-oh, things are diverging, I've got to renormalize. It's in a very different context, because everything that's going on here is sort of classical in the sense of it's dealing with, you know, solutions and geometries. So if I want to now look at this partition function, I've calculated my action, beta m on 2. So my entropy for example, is given simply by a derivative of the log of the partition function, so log of, sort of relating it to log of states. So if I now input my Schwarzschild action, I can see that, you know, my action is beta m on 2 divided by beta, I get m on 2, so I just have to say, well, how does m vary as beta varies? But then I calculated my periodicity, which is beta, to be 8 pi gm. So that simply says that, you know, I just get an 8 pi g sitting here. So that gives me a beta squared over 16 pi g, but then I relate my beta again to 8 pi g m. And I've got my entropy being proportional to m squared, which of course I can rewrite. As area over 4g. So I verified that not only did we on this path verify the temperature of the black hole, we've also now verified its entropy. So this kind of looks nice. We do have some self-consistent picture, but it also does raise a few questions. So let's just sort of look at some of the questions. Here we've said that T is 1 over 8 pi gm, at least in these almost Planck units. So what does that mean? Dm, if I look at how my mass changes then as temperature changes, that's negative. So I have a negative specific heat. If my black hole is radiating, it loses energy, the mass drops, so it gets hotter, so it loses more energy, so the mass drops more, etc., etc. So this is sort of not such a nice aspect. So if I ask, you know, here, if I do an estimate of how fast my black hole loses mass, it's going to look something like its area times your sort of Boltzmann factor, sigma t to the fourth. So that's your sort of standard radiation energy loss. I'm just going to put in the H bars and Cs here. This gives a factor for a lifetime of a black hole, which is proportional to its mass cubed. Now, sure, we've shown, you know, we've got this temperature here, 1 over 8 pi gm, but of course we've got to input factors of H bar and C. So we get H bar on the top line, C's on the bottom line, and we end up with something that's really, really tiny. So for all practical purposes, astrophysical black holes, you know, most sensible black holes, the temperature is just stupendously below, many, many orders of magnitude below the temperature of the microwave background. Where you can potentially get Hawking radiation is if a black hole is very small, so these could only have been formed in the early universe, sort of 10 to the 15 grams or so, these are now going to radiate hotter than the microwave background, and so these maybe have a chance to evaporate away. But the puzzle of black hole evaporation is definitely one that sort of constantly, you know, seems to have always been around and always seems to come back for a sort of new crack at, you know, trying to solve this issue. Because essentially you're saying that you can form a black hole classically, if you imagine an ideal empty universe, you go away, you leave it, it starts to radiate. Very nearly thermal radiation, and then at some point, poof, it disappears. So what happens? So we could imagine, for example, forming, you know, black hole, it's got some, throw lots of baryons in. Once the baryons have gone behind the event horizon, we don't any longer have access to sort of being able to count them. The thermal radiation is just going to chuck out particles quite democratically, or so we believe, and therefore we've lost the information of what formed the black hole. Pictorially, I might imagine a collapsing star. So this is like a cartoon. This is our singularity. This would be the event horizon. So this is a cartoon. Our Penrose diagram, on the other hand, which is our causal diagram, looks something like this. So that would be our black hole forming. So what then happens if it evaporates? Well, of course we don't know for sure, but we kind of conjecture that it looks something like this, where for a while we have an event horizon, which then goes. And so you can kind of see how you've lost, you know, if you ask what is our set of states, our sort of states on scry minus have to be sort of states on scry plus and states on H plus. So you can kind of see that we've lost information, or we've got this sort of non-unitary evolution. So this is one of the theoretical puzzles, which is recently claimed to at least have been solved to some extent, about black holes. So I'm going to stop there.
Why is the fact that the integral is divergent as m goes to 0 suggest the fact that you should subtract off the background factor?
It's not as m goes to 0, it's as r goes to infinity.
So you're saying, but you hold the integral to
0. Oh, grief. Right, what I meant, even when m goes to 0. Thank you for that. I think I said it, but I didn't write it. What I was saying was it's divergent whether or not you have a mass term. So it's inherently divergent. It's not divergent because it's a black hole. It's divergent because this boundary is getting bigger and bigger as you go to infinity. So I think I said that it's divergent even in flat space, but I agree what I wrote down looks very silly.
How would subtracting the black, how would you know prior that subtracting the black metric would help renormalize it?
So you don't know before you try it, but you use the fact that, for example, calculating the energy of the vacuum in field theory looks infinite when you first try it. So you kind of just subtract off the zero point energy, and then it all, you know, it helps. So you don't know till you try it. So you try something that's worked before.
We got temperature by identifying it as a periodicity
or
some coordinate. Isn't that a coordinate dependent statement?
So instead of tall, you write too tall.
In exactly the same way that you could use, you know, centigrade or Fahrenheit. Yeah, it's it depends on your definition of length. Yeah,
but the value of the action would be the same, so we also renormalize the area by or the entropy by the same constant factor. Right?
So let's see.
Can it be related to the fact that when you define the temperature using like the surface gravity and you like the Killing factors, it actually depends on the normalization, and in the same way you could renormalize the whole temperature just by scaling the Killing factors. So in that way, you're also doing the same.
I don't think that's sorry. So, from the perspective you're saying, that looks like a coordinate dependent thing. I'm sort of seeing that, except typically when you're looking at your metric and you go to asymptotic infinity, you normally say that your time coordinate tends to the time of an observer at infinity. So that tends to one. So from that perspective, you know, with that rule of the game, right, then you do have a uniquely defined coordinate. So because you have to take the, you know, the GTT tending to one at infinity.
But in some sense, the temperature is observer dependent.
Yeah.
Phenomenon.
As well.
So freely falling observer through the horizon can't see any temperature. So you have to, you know, fix the observer and then.
Because this is for a static observer at infinity, that sort of fixes our coordinate.
Well, I guess in this case, what you've done when you've done this whole approach, you've said, I am taking geometries that have periodicity beta. And so that's, if you like, what's fixed the statement. So you have made some statements that kind of fix, you know, what you're talking about. This is talking about, you know, geometries that have periodicity beta at infinity. So to some extent, like, you know, there is a sense in which, yes, you can always rescale what you're saying. But once you've kind of specified your asymptotics, you've specified your periodicity, you then work within that, you know, that constraint.